Welcome to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. This week, I meet Oscar nominee and new dad, Javier Bardem. We discuss this affable Spanish actor's edgy performance in Beautiful, a story set in the gritty underbelly of Barcelona. And from characters trapped in one city to a man who creates them, I head to London's heavens to meet Sir Norman Foster, extraordinary architect and the subject of a biographical documentary entitled How Much Does Your Building Weigh, Mr. Foster? And, light on his feet, Peter Bradshaw constructs and deconstructs this week's releases in our review section. We'll be looking at Clint Eastwood's Hereafter, Barney's Version starring Paul Giamatti, and we'll be discussing sex in Lover's Guide 3D. Yes, it's a towering edition of the podcast with a view. It's Film Weekly.
La señora.
Huevos fritos con salchichas y una tortilla de patatas con natillas y canela.
Una hamburguesa con... ¡Ay, va! ¡Cuánta patata frita! Se ha caído en el plato. Patata frita.
That's a scene from Alejandro González Iñárritu's Oscar and BAFTA-nominated film Beautiful, starring Javier Bardem as Uxbal, a single father and street hustler, desperately trying to protect his own children, but running out of time as he faces terminal cancer. Director Iñárritu has, of course, built a reputation on emotional films encompassing global issues such as 21 Grams and Babel. But Beautiful is really about a bravura performance by Javier Bardem, who won the Best Actor at last year's Cannes Film Festival for the role and now finds himself Oscar and BAFTA nominated for it too. His career has featured many tough performances in films such as The Sea Inside, No Country for Old Men and Mondays in the Sun. He is, of course, married to Penelope Cruz, and the couple announced the birth of a baby this week, too. They are Spain's golden couple, if you discount Xavi and Iniesta. And I've always found Javier Bardem one of the most likeable characters in real life. So I wanted to know why, as an actor, he was drawn to such complex and troubled characters.
It's the opposite, like in life. In life, I like things easy. But in drama, I mean, in movies or in as an actor, the more conflict the character has, the most important and rewarding to play him is, because then you have different scenarios that you can convey, and you have to convey, and you have to achieve. As an actor, that's a gift.
Yeah, it's true, because you always seem to me like a fun kind of guy. But your films, obviously some of them are comedies and they have a lightness, but the real ones, you get pretty down.
Well, I don't know. It's on my nature. I don't know. I like movies that speak about things that has a resonance on me, because they speak about things that are important to, I don't know, to understand. And this movie, Beautiful, has a lot of that. Yeah. So
it was interesting, because I think the film I'd seen you in before in Cannes was Vicky Cristina Barcelona. Obviously, you've been in No Country for Old Men before that. Then Vicky Cristina Barcelona. And I think Beautiful, he's back in Barcelona. And I'd just been to Barcelona when I'd seen this film to see my football team lose. But it was a beautiful day. I was like, this city's great. Yeah. And then it opens on Beautiful, and I'm like, is this the same Barcelona that I went to? Yeah. To see you in Vicky Cristina Barcelona, which is all lovely and brilliant and sunny, and then this one, which is cloudy and rainy, and which is the real one?
Both, and one. I mean, they are different sides of the same coin, and one needs the other one to survive. I mean, the Barcelona of Vicky Cristina Barcelona is real, and every summer, I would say every year, all the year, is packed by people looking for that Barcelona. And they find it, and it's beautiful. But then there's the other side that also fits that Barcelona, which is a huge, strong, long community of immigration that are working and doing things for the consumers that they don't see it, because it's totally in the extra radio. Both of them, but I think Barcelona, or London, or Paris, major cities in Europe have that same situation.
Did you know about it? I mean, you're not from Barcelona. You're from
Madrid.
You're from Madrid. You're not from Las Palmas, Gran Canaria.
Yes, I was born there, but my parents moved when I was three, I was raised in Madrid.
So even I assume Madrid has this kind of
totally
thing.
Totally, Madrid has that also, and I knew it, but in this case, I have the chance to be in the real places. Most of the actors that play those roles are real people going through those situations for real in their lives. which is kind of hard. Yeah. And then they are not numbers anymore. They are people, and which we all know, but we read about them, but we don't have the chance, most of us, to go and live in those places, yeah, stay with them, talk to them.
Which you did doing for this movie?
Yeah, we did, and very rewarding in the sense that that's why it's in the movie. It doesn't matter if you are from Nigeria, or from China, or from wherever, or from Barcelona. We all need and want the same things. We have the same needs, same fears, same things, and that's what makes them strong, because they know they share with us the same things, but we deny them those things for constantly, because we are in denial of them.
Yeah, interesting for you as an actor. You know, the bigger your career is, it's great. I love watching your career, and it gets bigger and bigger and more successful, and different parts. But to go back to do a film where you are mixing with people who aren't acting, who aren't Scarlett Johansson, who aren't Rebecca Hall, and aren't kind of gorgeous people, does that kind of feed the acting? It helps with the skills, going back to kind of, as I was saying, meet real people, but even more real than real. They're kind of people with difficult lives.
Totally. That's one of the great things of my job, is to have access to different people that otherwise it would have been difficult, or maybe never would have been able to see or to meet. But in this case, for example, the kids, helped me a big deal, because Alejandro and I, we were really focused on those kids to not get those images that they saw on the set. Sometimes were very difficult, very hard for them to see. Don't bring those images to their homes, to their minds. Yeah. And then we were playing with them. I was playing with them to their toys, to their child thing, and then Alejandro will say action, and those kids will start to pretend. And he will say cut, and those kids will come back to the games, to the toys. And then I saw, like, that's real performing. Mm-hmm. I mean, they didn't feel anything, they didn't care, they didn't was thinking too much about it. They just pretend to be those people in those circumstances, and they did great. Those things also helped me to see how fake of an actor I am. Like, I wish I could do that. That is,
yeah, you can go back to your toys.
Yes, actually.
You don't have children yet, do you? No. Did this film make you think you'd be a good dad? I think.
I don't know. The film really. I think this film really reads a lot of people, and especially fathers, because Alejandro and I, we were really aware that that was the core of the story. It's about the legacy that this person, who really has to face so many difficult situations, has to give to those kids. Like, of course, it's important to feed them with milk and bread, but also to feed them with some ethics or some spiritual guidance for them to grow up as people. And that's what he forgot. And he created this whole horrible world around him in order to survive, which is totally understandable because he has to feed his kids. But when he faces the end of his life, he realizes that he has to feed them with something else, and for that he has to change completely.
I don't know if this film did it for you, but you've been in done a film, and I know I spoke to you about The Sea Inside, which was kind of, it showed you another life through your performance. You saw into another world. I get the feeling that this film did that for you as well. Has it affected you? Has it changed you as a person?
Yeah, I don't think when you portray interesting roles, I don't think there is. It's not about method or anything. I don't care about labels. Labels, you say? Mm-hmm. I think every actor pretends to do the same, which is to be honest. I don't care how they try to achieve that. But there are certain roles like this where there's a moment where you don't see the line of fiction and reality, because it was 8 months for me. 3 months of preparation, 5 months of shooting. So there's a moment where you are so much in the fiction that, for example, I'm always saying that in the middle of the shooting, I feel this rush, me personally, of finishing things, of closing things, closing matters with people, friends, or I was anxious to shut down things that they were open. And that wasn't me. I'm not in a rush. I'm fine. I'm very patient, and I know things take time. The good things always take time. It was Uxbal. It was Uxbal with his own goal of numbered days, who made me wanted to close the things and be in a rush. And you know it, you feel it, you understand it, but even though you keep on doing it. And that's the weird thing. That's the when fiction gets into reality, which in this case it wasn't that harmful, but it can be harmful.
Yeah, but it's an interesting process to have that happen.
Yeah.
At least you didn't grow your hair into a ponytail, I'm pleased to see. Every time I see you, you have a new, strange new hairstyle. What is it with
you? This is for Terrence Malick.
This one is for Terrence Malick. Yeah, this is quite normal.
Yeah, it's quite normal. Actually, this is not the hair that I have in the movie. I cut my hair. The hair in the movie is... it's very particular.
Yeah, you become like the guy that they're going to do funny hair with. Let's get him in. Let's do Javier. He doesn't mind what hair we put on him.
Exactly. Well, actually, I think hair is important.
It is important. Especially at your age.
Exactly.
Yeah. You don't mind me saying
that. If there's a balding guy, there's a bald guy listening to this, you can say, of course it's important, you're stupid.
So the Terrence Malick film, by the way, exists. It's true.
It's true. Good. I work with him. I cannot say much, as you know, but... I only have to say that he has a great sense of humor. He made me fun a big deal.
Good.
He made me laugh a lot. And he combines also, once again, reality with fiction in a way that I've never saw before. Mm-hmm. And it's very unique how he puts that combination, mixture of reality and fiction, and covers it all with poetry. I mean, it's... I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, when are we going to see this film?
Maybe in 20 years.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's a short time for Terrence Malick.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, amazing to work with Terrence Malick. Congratulations on that. Woody Allen, Terrence Malick, Iñárritu, you're ticking them off now.
I am very lucky. Let's put it that way.
Well, when you are a father, good luck with that, because it's going to be great. Congratulations, and lovely to see you, Javier.
Lovely to see you. Thank you.
Beautiful is on release this coming Friday, the 28th of January, here in the UK. And if you want to win a special Bardem Iñárritu Spanish language Mexican film inspired box set we've got for you, we've got a 3 DVDs, including Amores Perros, Rudo y Cursi, and Vicky Cristina Barcelona, all up for grabs. To win those, all you've got to do is join us on Facebook, become one of the growing number of Film Weekly fans. That's our page. Just join by Tuesday the 1st of February to be in with a chance of winning that brilliant trio of DVDs. But joining me now to review some of the week's other releases is Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw. Lord Bradshaw, welcome.
Thank you, sir.
How lovely to see you.
Lovely to be here.
Going to talk about Clint Eastwood's new film,
yes,
Hereafter, which stars Cécile de France, among others, dealing with life in the hereafter. Matt Damon also co-stars.
I believe you recently did a reading for him.
All right, I'm just going to stop you.
Candace.
Okay, Candace, I don't do readings anymore.
You did one last week, Mr. Andrews.
I know. Well, he's an associate of my brother's. It was a one-time thing. I don't...
Please, I give you my word. I won't tell him anymore.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Listen. I brought money.
I don't want your
everything
money.
Everything I have.
I don't...
I lost my child. My only child. Just a baby. I just want to talk to her. Please, I want to talk to my baby.
I can't help you. I don't do that.
Now, here is Clint Eastwood, the sort of fractured narrative, people dealing with life in the possible hereafter. We start, of course, in the tsunami in Thailand. What I think is a very strongly handled scene.
It is. The opening scene, the tsunami scene, is very good. It's powerful. It's well made. You can sort of see the join in the digital work, but not outrageously.
Only when
so.
Big wave comes.
Yeah. Out. But that said, it's a very bold and quite an exciting start to the movie, and it leads you to expect something really quite special. But what you get is the most baffling and appalling TV movie-style thing about seeing ghosts communicating with the dead and the hereafter. It is utterly appalling. How Clint Eastwood came to be responsible for it, And Peter Morgan,
the great
smartest, snappiest, savviest scriptwriter we've arguably produced in the last 5 or 10 years. How he produced this soupy lot of nonsense is literally incredible.
Now, are we criticising the way the movie handles such spirituality, or is it just very difficult to do spiritual on screen? Peter Jackson, who made
the Lovely Bones,
Richard's Lovely Bones last
week. At least least it attempted, in however embarrassing a way, to imagine what the afterlife is. The afterlife is not imagined here, except in some very kind of blurry concept of a vast...
There are always children
endless plane
in the
of children.
Afterlife. You notice
yes,
that.
Yes, exactly.
That's
exactly.
The one thing I wouldn't want in the afterlife. I would try and get away from the noise
from
of
the
children.
Hoodies playing in the afterlife. I would, you know, get an Asbo slapped on them right away. And there are some moments when it is frankly badly directed. I think the two children in the London part of it are quite frankly badly directed. And I'm sorry to say they you know, they're just kids, but...
They're awful, aren't they?
They are frankly awful. Frankly, they're awful. But I don't blame the workers. I blame the management, in Sir Ben Elton's immortal words. I blame Clint Eastwood because of the way he directed them.
Yeah. He is closer to the afterlife, I think, than many filmmakers, alas. And he must be in touch spiritually. I was reading an interview with Sir Peter Hall the other day, who says he thinks about death
every day. He thinks about death
day.
Every day, yeah.
He's done it with Million Dollar Baby. He's dealt with death before. This felt like he really never even thought about it to me.
No.
He had no spiritual insight. No. And I thought this revealed him to be quite a shallow man.
I think he's having an off day, and like many great artists, he's saving up his off days for the very end of his life and his career. It's sort of sad in a way that he doesn't have a late period. He doesn't, like, as it were, Henry James or Beethoven, he doesn't have a late start. Or maybe he does. I mean, his two movies about the Second World War are profoundly admirable films.
Yeah,
I mean, perhaps they don't totally come off, but they were very important, I think, serious movies which would stand for his career-end movies in a way.
We'll move on to Barney's Version, Peter, because that's out this week, a film that stars Paul Giamatti, who won the Golden Globe for his performance. Also stars the lovely Ros Pike. I think that is her new name, in fact, the lovely Ros Pike.
She is the lovely, yes, exactly, exactly.
We'll christen her
like a sort of New Year's honours list. She is the lovely, T-L-R-P.
We shall patent that. It's based on a book by Mordecai Richler and stars Paul Giamatti. Here he is at his first wedding, finding out a bit of a surprise about his pregnant wife.
Clara Charnowski.
No, her name is Clara Chambers. Charnowski.
I was married to a Russian gangster for 5
Charnowski.
Days.
Charnowski.
I ran away on the honeymoon. I just never bothered to do the paperwork to change the name back.
Did you ever think to mention that?
Don't worry, baby. You still got yourself a true blue shiksa.
What else haven't you told me, sweetheart? Are there any kids I don't know about?
Only 2, Yossel and Chaim. They're locked in our attic. When you go out to get the hockey scores, I let them down and force feed them pork roast milkshakes through a funnel.
Paul Giamatti, I like him.
I like him as well. I think this is the best role he's had. It's still not nearly as good as his great roles in Sideways and American Splendor, but this is sort of the bronze medal. American Splendor having the silver, of course, and Sideways the gold. It does the most with him and with his sort of grumpy old face that we all love. He's the star in this what is, by any Yosek, I think, a very broad and indulgent Jewish comedy. But I like that sort of thing. Maybe
so do
you
I.
don't.
No, I do. What are you saying? Of course I do. That's how I grew up.
I like to think...
My life is a broad and indulgent Jewish comedy, Peter. What are you saying?
Yes, exactly. Speaking from my reactionary Anglo-Catholic perspective, Bryce Henry visited for me. I liked it. As I say, you have to be a bit indulgent. You have to have a little bit of a sweet tooth for it. But I kind of do. So I liked it. He is this guy who he's a sort of brash, hard drinking nowadays. In 2011, he would be described as a high functioning alcoholic. He's a Canadian TV producer who has a very weird and troubled past, and he's got rich producing a soap opera, and his life is kind of a soap opera as well. He almost abandoned his second wife, Minnie Driver, at the wedding reception when he had a coup de foudre and fell in love at the first moment of glimpsing her with Miriam, a very elegant intellectual woman, played of course by the lovely Rosamund Pike.
TM.
Who I think gives... It's a performance which may irritate some. I'd be interested to hear a kind of male-female kind of demographic vox pop on how they respond to Rosamund Pike.
People love Rosamund Pike,
yeah,
in a way.
Well, I love her as well. Who doesn't? Which red-blooded human being does not love Rosamund Pike? I love her. And she gives a very... Obviously a very elegant, shrewdly judged performance, picking out the way in which her character gets older. And I think that was quite well done.
And she doesn't do old makeup, which is
she doesn't.
No prostheticisms.
No, she doesn't. But she acts it very well. It's it's an example of what I can only describe as naff cinema. It's uncool.
It's pretty old school.
It's old school.
Dustin Hoffman is the kind of, you know,
as the dad.
The dad, Jewish cop.
Even
dad.
There, I thought, but compare him with his terrible performance in the Focke movies, and you realize that actually he's pretty good
much better,
in this film. Yeah, much better. Not at all annoying.
Yeah, that, there's or, a broad Jewish comedy that I could really do with that.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas this, I think, has got. It's got a big heart, which I think is never to be treated lightly in any movie.
I felt it was quite close to the reading a novel by Mordecai Richter. It had the right tone.
I must admit,
of
I haven't read it.
Novel.
Right. Okay. I must put my hand on my heart and say I haven't.
But I think
read
that might be why you enjoyed it, because it unfolded a bit like a novel. Mm. It wasn't a sort of bad adaptation. It felt the script. It felt almost written.
I sensed it was maybe, as it were, a little univocal in that it was from his POV all the time, and there wasn't a sense of how Miriam saw things, and certainly not how Minnie Driver saw things. We were not in the smallest bit interested, really, in how she sees it. It's, again, it's indulgent. It's about the man. Interestingly, perhaps tellingly, Miriam is seen reading a copy of Herzog, which gives, again, that where it's coming from, kind of Canadian, Chicago, Jewish guy of a certain age who's expected to have a string of ex-wives, and, you know, why are you on his case about that?
Yeah, there's also a murder mystery kind of at the heart of it as well.
Yes.
And a lake house and all of these things. And I do know people who kind of sort of, why should I want to watch this story about this alcoholic kind of schlumpy Jewish guy kind of who is obviously a bit of a sexist. I mean, if he worked for Sky TV, I don't think he would be that long for the job.
No, I don't imagine him getting on with. Well, he would get on.
He'd get on very well with Andy Gray.
He would get on with Andy Gray, although Rosamund Pike's character would not get on with
Andy Gray. Absolutely, no. She'd be tucking it in.
She would be tucking it in. Or rather not.
This is all,
we've got a bit of a Richard Keyes anti-hero banter going ourselves.
Yes, indeed.
Oh dear.
But Barney's version, we both quite liked. Well, I think, and we I did thought both. You would. I it is the sort of film
I did
quite
like. Lots of people, I think, are impatient with it, but and you do have to indulge it a little bit. I think you certainly do have to indulge it, but if you were mind to indulge it, then yes, it's an enjoyable film.
Given that we both quite shared the love on Barney's version, can we talk about another thing that we shared this week?
Yes,
it's
go ahead.
The Lover's Guide 3D. Yes. I've got to confess to everyone, Peter and I were two of a very few number of critics who entered a darkened room in Soho to watch erect penises being masturbated.
Yes.
We watched real sex.
Here comes the punchline.
We did in
3D.
Here
it comes. And then we watched the film. I thank
hey!
You. Oh, my goodness.
It's good night for me.
We did. I did enjoy it. I've got to say, the question of when we're going to get a proper 3D porn film is a subject semi-seriously raised occasionally. And there are people like Lars von Trier and Gaspar Noé who have sort of tongue-in-cheek said, yes, they're going to have a crack at it.
Yeah.
I suspect there's big money in a straight 3D porn film.
I saw one in Cannes, 5 minutes of a real... it was a bad, you know, bad film.
Proper bad porn film. Yeah. I'll tell you the interesting thing I had about... The thought I had about the Lover's Guide in 3D, quite recently the BFI released an excellent double DVD edition of The Joy of Sex Education, which is a fascinating history of sex education movies throughout the ages. And always you have the same thought, which you sit down, you start giggling, you take the mic, and then gradually it dawns on you, don't take the mic. They're actually showing you real sex.
Yeah.
All these other stupid feature films which sort of coyly try to be sexy and don't do the business.
With sax solos.
Yeah, with sax solos and top name Hollywood actresses who have wild sex scenes in their clothes, in theory to be wild and free, but really because, of course, they've got no nudity clauses in their contract. You suddenly realise how evasive and bad value these films are. Here is a film which, according to his lights, is actually showing you the real thing.
And how to do it, properly.
And how to do it. And you think there is a kind of honesty and candor and integrity in this film, which millions of other films do not have. However cheesy it is, and it is a bit cheesy, and I have to take the mic and say that it is structured in a very similar way to Woody Allen's Everything You Always Want to Know About Sex.
Without the sheep.
Yes, exactly. Well, there's another point. It has the series, it has the subject, foreplay, penetration, remember that, and then a demonstration for one of these four heterosexual couples. And of course, it's heterosexual sex we're talking about. Mm. We are talking very strictly... tasteful, monogamous couples.
I did notice there was one interracial bonding, which I thought was the big risk of this film.
Yeah, that was the one. They're not about any of the Larry kind of swinging scene, which Dr. Alex Comfort, of course,
The legend.
The legend that was Dr. Alex Comfort had no worries at all about. In 1972, we had some, you know, pretty leery early 70s sort of swinging stuff. Yeah. But there's nothing like that
there's
here.
There's not even a beard in this.
There's not.
I mean, no beard, hairy beard.
Yeah, and there's no beards, as it were, down below. It has very strictly to the contemporary porn aesthetic of shaven.
And yet also has the, sort of, all the eroticism of an airline safety video.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Where the doors are.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, it is absurd, and yet, you know, you have to give it some respect. Yeah. It does not coy. It shows you.
I wanted to sort of share with the rest of the room, which included illustrious people like Philip French.
Yes.
I wanted to turn around and sort of say, I think we all learned something.
Yeah, oh, we did. Oh, we did. We'll all pretend to be. We're all too cool to admit it.
Yeah.
No self-respecting sophisticate will ever pretend to be anything other than detached and amused by sex on screen.
There were some, I thought there were some rather large erections in that film.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, do you think so, Jason?
Yeah, I did. But I'm going to go and talk to Norman Foster about it.
Oh my God.
In the meantime, Peter, I'm going to thank you very much. Lovely to have you in the studio for the reviews this year. And I'll see you in a darkened room in Soho very soon.
Not off.
Nice one. I've had to leave Peter Bradshaw and The Guardian studios behind us. Film Weekly goes out and about. We've got a very important appointment on the 38th floor of London's most recent iconic building. Known to locals as the Gherkin, it is to the local postman, 30 St Mary Axe. And I'm standing outside it now, this huge, beautiful structure, this pickled cucumber thrown off and planted in the middle of London. I'm going to meet one of the world's greatest living architects, the man who transformed the London skyline and built this thing, Sir Norman Foster. So, let's go in.
Doors closing.
This week, his life and work is the subject of a striking documentary called How Much Does Your Building Weigh, Mr. Foster? It's directed by the Spanish duo Carlos Carcas and Norberto López Amado. I've pressed the hallowed 38th floor button. We're heading to the top of the Gherkin, to the private members bar, to meet Sir Norman and discuss the cinematic epic caresses that those cameras give his buildings all around the world, and talk about the importance of architecture, movies, to modern life. We have an appointment with Sir Norman.
Yes.
Sir Norman Foster, a very warm welcome to Film Weekly. What a pleasure it is to have you on. It's a pleasure to have anyone who's not a film star on. You know, to be the subject of a film makes you a film star. Although you do resemble Blofeld, as you're sitting in that chair atop a big building. There's a hint of Bond villain about you, so in the finest way, may I say. But welcome to Film Weekly. You're the subject of a film.
Have a very persuasive wife, is the answer to why.
Yes. Is it the sort of thing, you become the subject of a film, it's unusual for you because your buildings are so often sort of pictured themselves, to have you laid bare. Is there a reflection of you, yourself, in your buildings?
I think in a way I'm perhaps in this film a vehicle for the film to explore how buildings, how cities are created. And on the basis that the quality of a building, the quality of the infrastructure, what do I mean by the infrastructure? The streets, the squares, the parks, the public transport, the bridges, all those things that bind the building, that determines the quality of our lives. And we take it for granted. And if this film, in a way, stops anybody in their tracks and say, hey, you know, yes, I mean, it's been designed, and it was designed and created a century or two centuries ago. And, you know, what foresight. And aren't we, in a way, fortunate to have that heritage? And what are we doing now in terms of future generations who will look back in time?
It's a great medium for it. Film. It is, as I'm watching this film, the movie camera is a great way of capturing the spaces that you talk about, the roots to a building and its surfaces. And that's what they do. They caress the surfaces of your building.
Well, what is interesting is that the film makes architecture, design, cities, spaces much more accessible. It communicates, I think, very well. And architecture is notoriously difficult to capture on film because all our senses respond to the experience of a city or a building, which is a part of the of the cities. I think that's quite a challenge, and the way in which they use space and light and movement to show in a new perspective, I think is extraordinarily creative in its own right. I mean, this is just a great team, and I think that one of the ways in which I was able to relax and to forget the camera and became more a fly on the wall is the fact that as a team, we were together over quite a long period of time.
The title of the film is intriguing, and it explains it, but Buckminster Fuller asked you this question about your building in Norwich, how much does this weigh, Mr. Foster? And in a sense, you say in the film that gave you a new perspective on buildings. You actually came back with the weight. I'm probably going to have to ask you how much this place weighs.
I wish I could tell you. I need advance notice. I will come back.
You will come back. Excellent. Well, I look forward to having you back on that one. And I'll hold you to it. But in the way that that question sort of flipped certain certainties on your on their head and sort of changed the way you thought about things, has seeing your buildings in this film, the way they're shot, the way that they're filmed, the way that they are pictured, given you a sort of new insight to the way that you have approached your career?
Yes, I think that it has. I mean, I remember in the film very graphically the way in which the camera panned the countryside and then came across the Mio Viaduct. And that was truly a new perspective. It was a new way of looking at it. And
I mean it was an amazing shot, and the film makes much of your sort of love of flying as well, which you're still keen on, and you've still got your pilot's license, I assume.
Yes, I fly a tremendous amount. Yeah. I pilot less and less, more and more of a backseat, but I've been very fortunate.
Indeed, but I mean that must be sometimes how you see your own buildings. Did you take flights around them?
Yes, I think, and also, I mean, even being in the pinnacle of this building here and looking out of the window next to us and looking down on the city does give you a fresh perspective. You do, you start to see the importance of the river, the proximity of the river, the way in which certain buildings block access to it, the way that others open up. You see the way a park creates a green lung. It's extremely revealing and very educational.
You do sound like you've been followed by a film crew. You sound a bit like a filmmaker would sound.
Yes, I mean,
do you see some similarities between
there are similarities, absolutely. And I think that as an architect, there are certain film directors that one feels instinctively a kind of sympathy for. I mean, the films of Orson Welles, for example, I mean, are architecturally always inspired. Hitchcock, the way that a frame will be composed. So there, films like Metropolis, of course.
Have they long been an inspiration to you, films, in terms of their architecture?
Not consciously, but perhaps subconsciously, in the sense that before architecture even came as a word, I would be influenced by the films of Orson Welles. Mm-hmm. I think
would you go to that? Because the film takes us back to your house in Manchester where you grew up.
Yes.
Was that boy, looking out the window and doing drawings? Were you also going to the films as well? Because your drawings seemed to have a cinematic
feeling. In the world that I grew up, the cinema was also the source of knowledge. I mean, I remember seeing, as a child, the horrific scenes of the concentration camps as they were liberated. I mean, that was the cinema. The cinema was the equivalent in those days of what we take for granted with television and instant reporting. Mm.
So they were a window on the world as well for you. I'm wondering, because it is interesting to see your aesthetic develop over the course of the film. Was there moments like when Buckminster Fuller asked you how much your building weighs? Is it a developing aesthetic, and has it taken some influence from designs that one's seen elsewhere? I mean, I think of the sets of Ken Adams, Sir Ken Adams, who did all the Bond sets.
Well, I did a tribute to Ken Adams at an event in his in his honor. And I gave a short talk. And it's interesting, but I have two young children. And the Bond films are, I mean, there is no limit to the number of times that they can repeat view. I mean, it is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, in fact, there is a Bond film named after an architect, isn't there? It was Goldfinger. So that was
I'd forgotten that.
I mean, I find them architecturally fascinating. And Christopher Nolan's film, currently Oscar-nominated, Inception, has sort of these Bond villain hideaways, these kind of great architectural places. And in fact, folds Paris in on itself. Michael Caine plays the architect. Other people's visual work has the ability to astound
yes,
you.
Yes. We were talking earlier. I mean, this building that we're in here has been the subject of more than one film.
Yeah. Woody Allen used it. Mm. I think it was the first to use it. Match Point, it was his first film in London. I think he was the first to use it in a film, is that right? And he just opened. No, it was a pleasure to watch your buildings anew through the eyes of a cinema lens. So thank you very much for coming on Film Weekly. Great pleasure to meet you. And do call us back with the actual weight of 30 St Mary Axe.
I will indeed. Thank you.
Thanks. And how much does your building weigh? Mr. Foster goes on limited release here in the UK from this Friday, the 28th of January. For more information on the exact places to go for screenings, go to dogwoof.com. That's all for this week. The music we've been featuring on the show is from the soundtrack to Beautiful by Ravel and Argentinian composer Gustavo Santaolalla. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my Film Weekly producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye, and we'll see you next week if we ever come down.